Inheritance. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with the American Legion, presents a story out of that great composite of visions, struggles, and victories of the American past, our inheritance. Yes, we Americans are heirs to a vast fortune, a fortune composed of many things. Of hardy men forging tools to conquer a primitive wilderness. Of Paul Revere's Ride at Midnight. The voice of a great bell proclaiming liberty. It is a canal being built across fever-ridden Panama. And an airman alone over the Atlantic in the spirit of St. Louis. Let us now go back to a significant chapter in America's history, one which we all share in our inheritance. The expansion of America has been directly associated with the progress of transportation and communication. Significantly, no nation has contributed more to the development of these two fields, nor has any ever grown as rapidly as the United States. Today, these contributions are accepted as some of our most treasured inheritances. We offer now the narrative of one segment of those accomplishments, the story of the birth of airmail. It was summer in Lafayette, Indiana. At 8 a.m., the town barber opened his shop. While waiting for the first customer of the day, he relaxed through the latest edition of the Lafayette Daily Courier. On the front page, he read the following advertisement.
All persons who wish to send their letters to their friends in the East by airmail today must deliver them at the post office previous to 12 noon. Letters must be addressed via Jupiter. Airmail. I'm bejiggled.
The barber then wrote a brief note to a friend in the East, hung the back in 10 minutes sign on the door, and rushed to the post office.
Morning, Cal.
Oh, howdy, Jed. Don't tell me I'm going to get a few pennies from the tightest barber this side of the Atlantic.
Yeah, you can talk about being tight, but for a postmaster, you're sure looking a mite shabby around the edges. Could do with a little trim.
Yeah. Price you'd charge for a haircut, you'd pay a man to wear pigtails.
Yeah, wasting time and money gabbing with you. How much this newfangled airmail cost?
12 cents an ounce, or part thereof.
Don't go talking fancy, just weigh it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, 12 cents.
More than I get for a haircut. This should make good chit-chat around the shop. Politics talk is getting a mite touchy these days.
Yep. Oh, I better write down via Jupiter right in the corner there.
All righty. Here's via Jupiter. There. Think it'll get there all right?
Well, all depends. Let's see now. Destination is Philadelphia. Well, if the wind holds...
Wind? What is this Jupiter gadget?
A balloon. Free floating balloon. Yes, sir. And if the winds are just right, I tell you, we're going to see some real progress made this 15th of August, 1859.
But the winds weren't just right. In fact, it turned into a very calm day and the Jupiter drifted a mere 30 miles. Hardly an auspicious berth for such a giant as modern airmail. But then in 1903, two brothers named Wright and a place called Kitty Hawk entered the pages of history. Improvements followed rapidly as others all over the nation eagerly contributed to the development of the airplane. The infant grew, and by 1911, there was an air meet on Long Island, New York. One of the main attractions was the flight of the first official airmail.
Before I know what's happening, he's swearing me in, hands me this badge and 4 sacks of mail.
How are you going to get all those sacks in a plane?
I'm not. You're going to take 2 of them.
No, sure, if it'll help.
And we just dump them out of the plane when we reach Garden City, 10 miles from here.
Now then what?
You know, I'm glad you asked me that.
You are?
Yeah, because after we drop him, a post office driver picks him up.
Yeah.
Puts him in his mail truck.
Uh-huh.
And races like grease lightning to get him right back to the post office a block away from here.
Earl.
Hmm?
Just between the two of us, who dreamed this up?
App, if I knew, I wouldn't tell you. He's probably just a perfectly normal guy with a couple of kids, just trying to make a living.
Well, let's do it for the kids anyway, Earl.
Yeah. Yeah, App. For the kids.
Pilot was Earl L. Ovington, the first man in this country to carry official mail in an airplane. His sidekick, Hap, was then a lieutenant in the air service. Later, Henry Hap Arnold was commanding general of the United States Army Air Force. In the next 6 years, the establishment of an airmail network was frequently proposed in Congress, but by 1917, the airplane had achieved new prominence as a formidable weapon. Our entrance into World War I put a stop to the airmail plans of the Post Office Department. Then, early in 1918, Major General Squire of the United States Army invited Postmaster General Burleson to pay him a visit.
I got your call, Squire. Have to admit you made me curious.
Well, it's good to see you again, Burleson.
But will I be glad to see you?
I think so. Sit down.
Thank you.
Well, how's the airmail business, hmm?
Airmail? Airmail. Seems I once heard the expression.
Of course, I know it's been a long fight for your department, but you may be hearing the expression again.
Well, we haven't given up.
If you recall, I suggested that Army pilots fly the mail to the post office and consider it... military training.
Which would have been agreeable if the post office had the planes. But you made that suggestion nearly a year ago.
Yes, I know, and we ran into snags. Actually, I think Colonel Deeds has a better plan. An improvement on mine.
Deeds? I don't recall the name.
He's in charge of air service training. Anyway, he recommended that the Army itself carry the mail. Of course, I'll have to take that up with Secretary Baker at the War Department.
Yes, of course.
But I did want to check to see what you thought of the plan.
Squire, I'll go along with any plan that gets the mail where it belongs, in the air.
Eventually, Secretary of War Newton D. Baker agreed to the plan. This was it. The initial flight was set for May 15th, 1918. With planes to leave simultaneously from New York, Philadelphia, and Washington. Lieutenant George Boyle could see a sizable crowd at the Washington terminus of the route as he sat on a bench below the bleachers, waiting to pilot the first scheduled airmail flight in American history. The thousands of spectators packed into the polo field came as a complete shock to him. But there were further surprises awaiting Lieutenant Boyle, surprises he never dreamed possible.
Well, Lieutenant Boyle, how does it feel to be famous?
Oh, hi, Perrin. Nice to see a familiar face.
Yeah, cigarette?
Yeah, thanks.
Are you nervous or something?
Oh, not about flying the mail. But all these people here. I didn't know anyone was going to be here.
Well, that's a funny one. I guess you expected the president to send you a personal notice.
President? Of what?
The president, Wilson.
President Wilson? You mean he's here?
Of course. Where you been, Boyle? This place is filled with brass. It's Postmaster General Burleson, Assistant Secretary of the Navy Franklin Roosevelt, even a Japanese Postmaster General, not to mention your wife, kid, and the CO.
Oh, fine, fine. Why didn't they get Sophie Tucker and really make a show out of it? What's all the fuss about?
Airmail, you... What? Look, this is history. Why do you think you are the one that's flying it? You were voted the boy most likely to succeed in getting to Philadelphia. Now, there was a special meeting of the Signal Corps and the Post Office Department to pick you.
Who thought of me in the first place? That's what I want to know. Who nominated me?
Well, now, don't you go getting fussy with me. I just came out here to tell you mail's all loaded. Anytime you're ready to take off, go on.
You coming out to the plane?
Well, unless you can make contact while you're sitting in the cockpit.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Hey, you better kill that cigarette. It won't look dignified.
Let's go.
You're going to be a hero before this day's over.
So I'll give you my autograph.
Boyle, Lieutenant Boyle. In just a minute.
Hey, it's Burleson, the Postmaster General. Mind your manners now.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I didn't see you. Is everything all right?
Yes, it certainly is. I just thought you'd like to know the president was asking about you. I told him you were the finest pilot available for the job. Nothing to worry about while Lieutenant Boyle is flying the mail.
Well, thank you, sir. I'll do my best.
Well, that's good enough for me. Well, I won't hold you back. Just let me congratulate you before you take off. Good luck, Boyle. It's in your hands now.
Thanks again, sir.
Field's clear, Lieutenant. Ready?
As ready as I'll ever be. Okay. Contact.
There it goes.
Now, try her again.
Right.
What's the matter, Perrin? Are you weak?
No, she's catching, but you won't hold.
Let's get going. I'm supposed to be making history, remember?
Okay. Didn't even catch that time.
Better call that mechanic.
Yeah. Hey, Max. Over here, Flash. What's the trouble, Boyle?
She won't turn over.
Well, let's have a look at her.
Make it quick, will you? I got a feeling I'm embarrassing my CO.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Fuel line's okay. I know the battery's good. I just checked it.
How about ignition wires?
Well, this cap here is a little loose. That could do it. Let's try it again anyway. Okay, Boyle, try it now.
You ready, Perrin?
Right. There it goes.
Oh, what the dickens?
No good, huh, Lieutenant?
Do something, will you?
Can't figure out what's wrong.
Hey, wait a minute, Boyle. I just thought of something.
Where you going?
Well, just back here. Yeah. Yeah, I thought so. Hey, Mac, do me something, will you?
Sure.
Just get every one of those mail trucks and all the other vehicles on the field over here right away.
Well, what's the idea?
Never mind. Just get them.
Well, if it makes you happy.
Well, what's wrong?
Oh, nothing much.
What do you mean, nothing much?
Well, just that no one bothered to put any gasoline in your tank.
Aviation was still in its infancy that day, and if there were any doubts about it, that mishap would have confirmed them. But a few minutes later, Perrin and the mechanic finished siphoning the gasoline from the trucks into the airplane, and again an impatient hush fell over the polo field.
Okay, Perrin, let's try it now.
Right, Lieutenant. Okay.
Contact.
Contact.
Okay. You heard it back now, help! Yahoo!
The plane was airborne, the crowd cheered, the birth of airmail, though amusing, was successfully accomplished. American determination had given a new concept to the transmission of the written word. And the mail had wings. Put yesterday next to today. The world of 35 years ago is a far cry from the one we know today. Put a Hispano-powered Jenny next to a jet-propelled bomber. Compare them, if you can. For comparison only proves there is no comparison. Lieutenant George Boyle remembers.
A man could run up a flight of stairs almost as quickly as planes could climb. Today's automobiles cruise the highways nearly as fast as yesterday's planes could fly. Polo fields and racetracks substituted for airfields. The distance between them was but a few minutes less than a tank full of gasoline. The most common navigation aid was a road map issued by gasoline stations for their customers. Men had to learn to fly, and there were few who could teach them. Every airlane was a new one, never flown before. A and the pilots, daring young men taking great risks. The altitude became a guardian, repelling all trespassers, seeking to preserve its privacy.
Lieutenant James C. Edgerton was chief Army flyer carrying the mail in 1918. In light of comparisons, his log reads like an imaginative tale, filled with adventure and incredible exploits.
Well, it had been like every other day carrying the mail. I returned from Washington to Philadelphia with the northbound mail on schedule. After the plane was unloaded, Mac Connors spotted me and came running frantically from the hangar.
Lieutenant Edgerton! Lieutenant! I've been waiting for you.
What's up?
Well, everything, except the mail to New York.
What happened to Webb?
Well, he took off all right, on schedule. But he lost his way and made a landing at Bridgeton, New Jersey. Got all tangled up with a paddock of horses.
But didn't he get the mail back here?
Oh, sure, and then Lieutenant Culver started flying it to New York. But he was forced back in less than 5 minutes. Engine trouble this time.
Where's the mail now?
Here in the hangar. There was nothing I could do with it until you got here.
And Culver?
Yeah, I gave up trying to fix the thing. But Culver's still in there working on it. Some days it just don't pay.
Lieutenant Howard Culver was almost as good a mechanic as he was a pilot. I figured he'd had the plane repaired by now. But when I walked into the hangar, Culver was busily engaged sewing a button on his uniform. Hey, Culver, what do you think you're doing?
Oh, hi, Edgerton. I'm trying to sew this button on.
Buttons? What about the plane? What about the mail?
Well, take at least another hour to finish that plane.
Well, then, finish it. We got to make New York yet.
Relax, Lieutenant. Another half hour and it'll be dark. Won't be able to fly anyway.
That late?
It is. Say, Lieutenant, what do you know about threading a needle?
Hey, Culver, call up Belmont Field. Tell him to watch for me.
What's the matter? You nuts or something?
Maybe. That slogan they keep throwing at us. The mail must go through. It keeps going round and round in my mind.
Lieutenant, it'll be black as pitch before you're halfway there.
Well, I'm supposed to be in this for the experience. So, I'm going to get me some. A moment later, I was flying off into the gloom, wondering if I'd ever make another takeoff. Below me, there was nothing but a sea of blackness that stretched from one horizon to the next. Occasionally, there would be twinkling lights in the distance. These would be the villages, I thought. But which one? Palmyra? Beverly? Bristol? Maybe Windsor or New Sharon? I kept assuring myself it didn't matter. If I hit the ocean too soon, I'd just turn north. I'd have to hit Rockaway or Long Island. My mind was whirling as fast as the propeller. Finally, the lights of New York City appeared as a welcome and unmistakable glow on the horizon. Minutes later, the fuel tank nearly empty, Long Island was below me. I banked low and headed for Belmont Field, knowing the few lights there would hardly distinguish it from my own backyard with the porch light burning. I dipped and circled, peering through the night for some sign of the field. It was just about empty when suddenly I saw the field, burning brightly, alive with light. But what made it so brilliant? I decided that was no time to ask questions. That was the time to make the landing.
Good landing, Lieutenant.
Perfect. Hey, where's the truck for this mail?
That's coming right now.
Good. Now, will you kindly tell me where on earth you got all those lights?
Well, sir, we got a call from Philly, said you were coming in at night. So we sort of took over every automobile in the neighborhood and any that happened to be passing by. Parked them in a circle around the field and had them turn their headlights on. Seemed to work okay.
Oh, it worked okay, pal. It worked very okay.
By August 12, 1918, the Army had completed its exploration of the skies between Washington, D.C. and New York. The job of delivering mail was returned to the Post Office Department. The atmosphere was colonized, but it was still a frontier, and new problems entered the picture.
Look at that weather, Burleson. Sure, it's a local storm, but 100 miles away, there may be another storm worse than this.
Squire, this is typical of the weather our pilots are going to learn to fly in.
I can't say that I envy your position as Postmaster General. Airmail is operating at a considerable loss, and you're not going to draw better business until you fly the mail to the middle of Far West.
We know that. Weather, distance, darkness. We've got to lick 'em.
I guess we all dream about a coast-to-coast flight.
It'll be done, Squire, sooner or later.
But hardly a job for the post office department. You can't expect your pilots to risk their lives so that there'll be enough money to balance the books.
Well, I can't argue that point. But something has to be done about flying the mail to the far west. Something.
And something was done. In October 1919, 64 daring pilots were sent on a round-trip transcontinental race by the Army Air Service. As a result of this maneuver, many questions were answered. And some of the answers came from the winner, Lieutenant Belvin W. Maynard, when he was interviewed by a representative from the press.
Well, Lieutenant Maynard, to avoid confusion, I'll ask the questions for my colleagues
here. Yeah, fire away.
How long did it take you to make the round trip?
Well, the elapsed time was 9 days, 4 hours, and 25 minutes.
Oh,
yeah, and I know you're probably thinking that's no improvement over railroad schedules, but considering the type of equipment, the unknown terrain, the lack of flying fields...
I think you'll find, Lieutenant, that the public and the newspapers are very much impressed with the experiment.
Yeah, that's right.
But inasmuch as it was an experiment, what would you say aviation has gained from the flight?
Well, I think the main thing is we've learned that there can be no westward expansion by air until there are adequate landing fields all over the country.
That alone would do it?
Plus, and this is a big plus, a beacon system. We can't shave much time off the flight without incorporating night flying. But for that, we have to have a trail of beacons set up across the nation's danger points. Only then can we have airmail coast to coast.
...1921, boom year for flappers, jazz, and barnstormers. There were over 10,000 flyers in the country. Pilots everywhere were buying planes from the Army for as little as $500... ...and then flying them all over, giving exhibitions, doing stunts.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, my partner will fly at top speed... ...and approach the grandstand upside down.
Hank and Charlie Carruthers were two of hundreds drawn by the exciting possibility of night flying.
Listen to me, will you?
Ah, don't get so serious, Hank. Not only my birthday, but I'm old enough to vote and to get married. Furthermore, I'm starved.
That's just the point. Who'd marry a couple of barnstorming lunatics like us?
Susie?
Listen. This is practically a lifetime job I'm talking about. They figure it'll take them at least 3 or 4 years to complete it.
Okay, okay. But save it'll after the food gets here, huh?
They got an 80-mile stretch between Dayton and Columbus that's completely marked for night flying. The post office likes this idea. They want to do the same thing between New York and San Francisco so there can be no coast-to-coast airmail without switching to trains as soon as it's dark, you know.
Look, Hank, as long as Susie's here in New York, what do I care about coast-to-coast airmail? And where's the dinner?
The idea is they need someone to do some night flying and check their markers for them as they build them. Someone to make sure their beacons make the route safe to fly at night.
Night flying? Well, go on.
That's it.
This a definite offer?
This guy wants to meet us first. We'll see if he's still there as soon as we're through eating.
Hang the dinner. We don't want to miss out. Come on, let's go.
Hank and Charlie Carruthers were just two of the forgotten legion of men who literally blazed a trail across the continent. And by 1925, beacons shone from every danger point between New York and San Francisco, 3,000 miles away.
Where do we get to San Francisco? We'll really live, he says.
Quiet, I'm busy.
Who are you writing to?
Who do you think? Susie.
Not the Belle of Brooklyn.
Quit being funny and give me 24 cents.
For what?
For an airmail stamp. And hurry, will you? There's a line already.
Line? Where?
At the post office. Today's the day they're inaugurating coast-to-coast airmail service. What do you think we've been working on the last 4 years? Hank, this is the greatest thing that's happened to the mail since they invented writing.
The job was done. The dream a reality. From those crude beginnings, those courageous experiments, we have inherited the airways, communications, navigation aids, and multi-engined aircraft that are the cornerstones on which our present worldwide structure of delivering the mail is built. For today, the states are literally united by an airmail system that puts mere hours as the only barrier between the posting of a letter and the delivering of it. Every second of every day, a million letters are airborne, and the sender knows that a few pennies will carry his note around the world. The odds, 1,000,000,000 to 1 against the failure of delivery. American ingenuity has left us an inheritance of a faster and more reliable method of carrying our written word around the earth than centuries of dreamers ever dared to imagine. You have been listening to Inheritance, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the American Legion. We are privileged this evening to hear from the past National Commander of the American Legion, Department of Washington, D.C., Mr. Lewis Johnson.
At its first convention in 1919, the American Legion went on record in support of the Boy Scout movement as a most valuable contribution to nationwide youth training activity. Organized guidance and cooperation with the Boy Scouts of America began in 1922, when scouting was included in the activities of the Legion's Americanism Commission. Since then, sponsorship of community Boy Scout groups by local Legion posts has increased steadily until today, when we find nearly 4,000 units are headed by Legionnaires. As a past National Commander of the Legion, and as a member of the Council of the Boy Scouts, I am happy to be one of those Legionnaires who has made some small contribution to this program. Scouting was organized to bring the benefits of the program, outdoor activities and vocational guidance, reaching and serving more than 20 million scouts and leaders since its beginning in 1910. Training for citizenship is the aim of scouting. From Cub Scouts of 8 years old, to Boy Scouts of 11, to Scout Explorers of 14 or older, boys develop into men, fine in character, healthy in body, skillful with the hands, and ready to help other people at all times. Thus, a close bond between the Legion and the Boy Scouts has been established. They have a common aim, to make young Americans physically strong, mentally awake, and morally straight, and better able to perform their duty to God and to country, the two great fundamentals of our American inheritance.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis Johnson. Next week, Inheritance will take you on another journey through the pages of history to a time when Americans dreaming of the future forged that which we possess today. Today's story, The Mail Had Wings, was written by Robert Malcolm Young. Included in the cast, in order of their appearance, were Jack Moyles, Leroy Leonard, Olin Soule, Bert Holland, Barney Phillips, Vic Rodman, Joe Cranston, Jack Edwards, Tom McKee, Bob Emmeline. This program was directed by Art Jacobson. The original music was composed and conducted by Robert Armbruster. Inheritance is produced for the National Broadcasting Company and the American Legion by Albert McCleary. This is John Wall speaking. This is the NBC Radio Network.